Okay, class, I have your papers graded. I'm going to pass them back today. Again, we'll have a little bit more discussion on the assignment and on the format, that verse analysis format, and then we'll probably close that area out today and move on into another area. So the first thing I want to do is pass the papers back to you. I see there's a few people absent today. I see Steve Throckmorton's not here, Rick Maddock, Tate, George. Rick Cameron's not here. Keith. Mark. If you didn't turn one in, I still suggest you go ahead and get one in, and I can give you some credit on it. Would be better than no credit at all on it. So go ahead, and if you can get them in within a week, I can still give you something on it. Now, what I'm going to do, I got permission from George Ng to photocopy his assignment that he did. I thought he did an excellent job, and it would give us kind of a reference point from which we could further discuss the assignment if you had any more questions or comments to make on it. And I thought you might enjoy having your own personal copy of his, what he did on it, and be able to use it for future reference as an example of applying this survey or this verse analysis to an Old Testament scripture. So I'll go ahead and pass some copies out to you. Yes, he typed it. That's why he got his A+. The rest of it's terrible, but he typed it so neat that I had to give him an A+. No, I'm just kidding. He did an excellent job. Now, for those listening on tape that are absent or sick or on tape, we'll have a copy for you in the student mail if you want to check it. Okay, now, just looking over his paper briefly, what you might want to do is get out your outline, study outline, in case you want to follow along with it through the paper. And I'm not going to discuss every point in it, but I'm just going to show you basically how he did it. I think he did a real good job. First of all, he followed precisely the outline as it was given, which is what I suggested you do when you do the assignment. Not that would always be the way you'd want to, you know, if you were doing a formal paper. Let's say if you were writing for the Journal of Biblical Literature, you know, you'd be writing on a very scholarly level. And if you were writing an extensive exegetical analysis on Hosea 11:7, and you'll see these type of things, by the way. That's where you find this type of study usually done, not in a book, but in a religious periodical or a theological journal. You'll see they do things like that, very, very detailed, in-depth studies on even just one verse or one word or something, some aspect of something. But anyway, if you were writing for that type of thing, you might want to put it more in a paragraph fashion with maybe some outline headings and pretty much do it that way. But the reason I suggested that you follow pretty closely the outline that we gave you was just for purposes of clarity, conciseness, and ease your first time through, so that you'd be able to follow what we gave without getting confused. Anyway, we follow through here. We see author Hosea, date, place. All your background material has been filled in. And then it gives you the sources at the bottom of that for that first information. Second, the textual and grammatical overview. The literary genre or type, it's historical and prophetic. Prophetic in the immediate context there. And then interlinear. He said, see, the kingdom are linear for Greek and J. Green for Hebrew. And then he wrote, impossible pointing does not affect the verse. What he means as to the ultimate interpretation of it. Any variation in pointing wouldn't... in fact, there really aren't any variations in pointing in this verse, are there, George?
No.
The variations were on the meaning of the words or what the definition would be rather than alternate pointings. I don't think there were any alternate pointings offered.
One guy for yoke instead of upward.
Okay, so there was one on one word.
I know it's also in the Hebrew lexicon. The next word in the lexicon is yoke.
Uh-huh.
It's a change in the balance.
Okay, so there would be one that you could put in there.
Instead of bow tie or upward.
By the way, I'll recommend Mark's too. I didn't photocopy his because it was a little bit longer and I didn't want to photocopy all kinds of things. But if you want a very, very detailed one that adds a lot of good background information, his paper goes into real depth and I thought he did a real excellent job also. So anyway, the textual and grammatical overview, interlinear, and then he parsed it. So you see that he actually broke down the main words in the verse in the Hebrew and gave what part of speech they are. Now, one suggestion I might offer on this area for you if you do this in the future, whenever you're writing a paper, now this may vary somewhat depending on, you know, who your audience is, but I would say that for general purposes this principle would hold true, and that is that whenever you're writing a paper and you're dealing with a foreign language, and in our case it would almost always be either Greek or Hebrew, maybe sometimes Aramaic, and whenever you're actually writing foreign words, Greek words or Hebrew words, I feel it's always a good idea to give the transliteration of that word and a translation of it for the reader who may not be knowledgeable in that language. So, for example, here, the second word down is, I'm not sure the pronunciation, teloim, I think, and it means are bent. So if you had to put maybe the Hebrew letters and then teloim and then the translation, if you're going to give that translation, are bent, that would have identified that word for the reader, or maybe even just given an interlinear of it, like for the Greek interlinear. The third word down is they call him. Third word down is to backsliding for me. That's the backsliding word. Metuba, I think it is. The fourth word down is they call him. Fifth word is at all. And the last word is would exalt, or if you supply him, would exalt him. So we broke it down, did a good job of parsing, simply a grammatical description of the Hebrew words there. Then on the second page, he mentions the variants. Ibn Hebraica lists several textual references in the Masorah Parva, the small Masorah, gives the questionable corruption probabilities. They won't be taken into account in his study, and most probably because he didn't feel it affected the ultimate interpretation of the verse, so that it would have been a waste of time. And see, that's the kind of decision you've got to make when you go through this kind of thing, as to whether it's going to significantly affect the meaning of the verse or not. In some cases it will, and then you'll want to list them out and work on them. Interpretive problems, nothing wrong with the text. Lexically, there's a question on the Hebrew word, whether it means to upwards or to the Most High. And so there's one of the problems that will have to be solved in interpreting this verse. Does it mean that they were calling the people upwards, or that they were calling them to God, to the Most High, who is upwards or the Most High? And he says the translators usually pick one. The view is that to upwards is to heaven, where the Most High dwells. Thus, there's no contradiction. So he's harmonized it now. He feels that it's secondary as to whether you translate it to upwards or to the Most High, because to upwards can only refer to the Most High. To go up spiritually is to be drawn toward God, and so he sees a harmony in the two there. Another question is, should that Hebrew word be translated exalt or raise? Meaning, the second part of the verse where it says, but none would at all exalt him? Well, does it mean that none would exalt God, or that none could be raised up? You know, should it be taken transitively or intransitively or reflexively? Grammatically, who is the object of the exalting or raising, Israel or God? In other words, the question I just posed, are they exalting God or are they being raised up themselves? The object of the call, Israel or God? In other words, as they called them, who is them referring to? Paul says the problem is at the start of the verse, the writer believes it's at the end of the verse. Then no problem in the other areas. Textual analysis refers you to another section in the paper, another source. Then the next page, structural analysis, he actually diagrammed the Hebrew. And I had time to only check out a couple words there, if you want the English equivalents. The first, the top line there on the left is my people. George can correct me if I'm wrong on any of these. Can be translated my people. Then there's a slash, then on the other side is our bent on the top. And then the slanted line down there on the right is two backsliding from me. And then the bottom, then the second line down on the left, well, in the middle you've got the conjunction and, I think. Mm-hmm. And then you've got they call on the left. And then on the right, he supplied him or it by the verb. And then I didn't have time to do the others. What's on that slanting line there, George?
That's to the Most High.
Okay, to the Most High.
And the last one is the last word, to raise.
Oh, to raise or to exalt?
Yeah.
Okay.
And the bottom is not.
Not, would not, okay.
No one, not, but the bottom.
Okay, good, thank you. So you did a good job on that. Lexical analysis. Locating the word, this is the word to exalt here, isn't it? Right. And so an A, locate the word, is that verb, to raise or to exalt. He parsed it, then he gave an inductive study that historically it comes from another word which means to lift up, a root, to rise, to be exalted, or high. So that's the etymological study, that's the root it comes from. Current usage, this rare form is not listed in the Septuagint. Bible usage, this form of the root is found 16 times in the Old Testament. Contextually, appears only once, only this verse by Hosea, 16 times in the Old Testament, and then he gives several cognate words in the Hebrew language that are similar, to be lifted up, haughtiness, height, high, high place. No synonyms found in source 51, which is, what is that, girdle stone?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And multiple meanings, see various sources. Grammatical analysis, the accident or form is given. Any variations on the form are given. Then the syntax, the key words, the word order, shows in the front shows emphasis on my people, emphasis on destination upward or to the Most High. Normal punctuation, forms are common, but the one verb is a rare form. Then he just explains the context. Briefly, from the word to the phrase to the tenor of the Bible, in other words, all context, it fits perfectly. There's no theological conflict. Parallel constructions, common interpretation is the problem. And style, prophetic combinement and emotional heart, special usages. Then the historical analysis, most of it doesn't apply in this case. It does give us the background of the author, the reader, the writing. Theological, no problems. Again, it's all just to the interpretation of the verse, the identity of the people and who's being exalted and so forth. Exegetical analysis, and then the next page is conclusion. I thought he did a real good job on the translation here. First he gave you what he felt was the translation, and then he keyed it by means of these letters to a legend at the bottom explaining who he feels is identified. And so, my people are bent to backsliding from me, and then they call him or it to the Most High or upwards. No one, he or it, would exalt intensively. And then supplied him or the Most High. And then A, they, is found in the verb. In other words, the verb call, to call includes the pronoun they. Is that correct, George?
Yeah, right.
And then B, would call him or it. That's again found in the verb. So he supplied that correctly from the verb. See, the Most High or upwards. And there's where you've got a distinction. And that's where you have to make a decision. And he's opted for the Most High, but he's put in parentheses upwards because the concept can be there. And my feeling in the Hebrew is that a lot of times it's purposely vague so that you can see more than one application or meaning there. Still means you have to come down, generally, if you're going to be a translator on one side or the other, and maybe you can get a little bit of compassion for the translators, Rotherham, the New American Standard, and others, that have to decide, just by the very virtue of being a translation, what they're going to put in the text and what they're going to put in the margin. And I suppose sometimes, like in this case, it's so close that it could really almost go either way. And it's almost a matter of flipping a coin, whether you're going to put one or the other in the text. But But he's wanted to put the Most High in the text because it's obviously referring to God, even if it's upwards. And then he's relegated upwards to parentheses. Then he's got a footnote C there, the Most High or upwards, different translations, but the same concept, upwards to the Most High. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if the Amplified translation, which I didn't check on this one, had both concepts in it. That's the advantage of an Amplified or expanded translation, that they can throw in all the idiomatic concepts involved in a word and put them all in there. Then D, no one, it's he or it's on in the verb, would exalt, a rare verb form here, determined to be Hillel and Kolel. Notice certain translators use reflexive. Though the verb is cal intensive active, their translation is similar to the hispel, another form of the verb. This writer disagrees. It should be translated as cal intensive active, is not reflexive. In other words, he gives it an active translation, meaning would exalt, and then gives it an object, him or God, rather than none would be exalted, reflexive, or none could exalt himself or raise himself. Then for F, him or the Most High, the active verb requires a direct object, which is determined by the context in this case. Him, the Most High, it's God, of course, in this case, so the Most High you could supply. Okay? And then last page, interpretation. Israel is bent to backsliding from God. The past prophets, they, verse 2, have been calling him, Israel, upwards to the Most High to see the goodness, grace, and patience of their God. Yet they still refuse to exalt, raise, lift up, extol the Most High. Therefore, it is proper to say that Israel is bent to backsliding from God. Note, if one translates the last verb in the reflexive, it still fits the tenor of the Bible. The meaning would be the prophets called him to the Most High or upwards. No one would raise himself up. There's reflexive, where the action comes back on the subject. That is, to go into the Most High. So none of these, really, and perhaps in this sense, I chose a poor verse, although I didn't want to choose a verse that was purposely controversial in the theology, because I didn't want you to get so hung on the theology that you missed the whole intent, which was to get you to become familiar with this outline and how to use it. But in this case, it really didn't make any difference, I believe, theologically, whether you translate it to upwards or to the Most High, whether it would exalt themselves or would be exalted. The point was clear, and the concept is this, that the prophets were being faithful to call to the people of God. But though they were faithful to continue to give God's call to his people, none of God's people would hearken to that call. Whether you want to translate it, hearken by raising themselves up to a place of spirituality before the Lord, or whether you want to translate it, would exalt God and put him in his proper place in their hearts, it's still the same point theologically. And the point is, God's faithfulness through calling to the people by the prophets versus the people's unfaithfulness in not hearkening to that call.
Yeah, Mark, I noticed in some translations they said God would not exalt Israel upwards. No.
So they supplied...
God wouldn't do it. But uh-huh. The next verse contradicts that because he will return.
Right.
But after a period of testing.
Right. In fact, to me, it would almost even contradict the first part of the verse where it says, though they call them, and that they would have to be the prophets. And so it would be God calling through the prophets, but not God exalting. But why was he calling? He was calling for the purpose of raising them up and for, you know, exalting them for a nation. So to me, it would almost contradict the same verse. And that would have some theological implications of Calvinism.
Like
right.
He stuck them on a pole of pots.
Right. Right. He predetermined them to do this and to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there could be some theology there.
I also found in the usage of that verb exalt and the philel, which is the same as the polel. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if they're both the same. It's never used reflexively.
Uh-huh. So there would be no precedent.
Either
for
it has to be God exalting them or they exalting God.
Uh-huh.
And never used reflexively.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And there's also that one verb, or one adverb in there, all together. You know, they acted as a unit.
Uh-huh.
They wouldn't, as a nation.
Okay.
You know.
Good. Well, any comments or questions? I have a couple more comments I want to make, general comments on the study outline for verse analysis, and then we're going to get into another area. Larry?
I just want to mention I was impressed on the usage of the word there when I was looking up the word on bend, or some translations say hung,
yeah.
And how it was only used three times, and how it was used as hung or hanging.
Uh-huh.
And it gave me, I read in one particular commentary, the sense of my people are suspended upon apostasy, showing the particular position they put themselves in, even though they wanted to, as if they were hung up on this stake, so to speak, labeled apostasy, and they couldn't get off it. It kind of reminded me of a playful cartoon. You know, here's a stake, apostasy written out there, hung on it, and they're trying to get off it, but they can't.
Uh-huh.
Even though they have the desire not to, yet not at all would they be able to.
Yeah, it really is. And that translation is intriguing because it makes you wonder what is the analogy that he would have in mind if you were to carry that concept over, you know, in this place where it's used. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in today's idiom, you could almost say they really had a hang-up. You know, they were really hung up, you know, literally, on apostasy. Yes.
The Septuagint uses the same verb, suspended, and that's the verb used for on the cross.
Is that right?
Hanging on the cross.
Huh. That's interesting.
And also in the usage in the Old Testament, refers to the Philistines hanging up Saul and his sons on the wall.
Uh-huh.
Some wall in the Philistines. Hmm. Some Philistines town. It's like they're on a wall of pots. I mean, they're just
Hanging there
for everyone to see.
Uh-huh. And that would show, in view there would not be the human side of how they got there. We know that they got there through their own fault.
Yeah.
But it would be showing the result of what, once they got there, they're kind of stuck. You know, they're kind of stuck there. You know, you've made your own nest now sleep in it, you know, so to speak. And that's an interesting translation. On this, to get back to my page here, I want to be on. Okay, I mentioned the one remark already. When you're using Hebrew or Greek words, I believe it's always best to give a transliteration and a translation for the benefit of your reader. So first, you give it in the character in the. For example, if it's a Hebrew word, give the Hebrew characters first. Okay, write those out. Then put a comma, and after that, put the English transliteration of those characters. Then another comma, and give the English translation or meaning of that word. Okay, and if you follow that out, I believe you'll always. You'll never keep your reader in the dark that way. If they don't have linguistic ability, they'll be able to follow right through. I think I see one drawback in this whole verse analysis outline, and of course we made it with the fact in mind that there were limitations to it, and it was only kind of a means to an end. But one drawback I found in using it is that it kind of forces you to separate different areas of Bible study that sometimes would naturally be combined. When you're studying. In other words, you find that when you're under interpretive problems or when you're under grammatical analysis or lexical analysis, you're forced to limit your remarks just to the lexical analysis or just to the grammatical when your mind wants you to tie it in with the other parts or areas of the problem. Now, that can be a drawback and it can be a plus. The way it can be a plus is that it forces you to look at that area and not just let your mind go to where you feel the problem is. It forces you to check out thoroughly, you know, the lexical meaning of that word and what's involved in it. The drawback is sometimes it isolates that area of Bible study from the grammatical or from the syntactical, whereas really they all go together when you're looking at it. One problem or area reflects on another. And of course, even though at the end we told you at the very last point, or point 8 or whatever it is, collate, that's where you're supposed to draw everything together. And so you're supposed to read back over your whole paper, and then you're supposed to correlate the evidence. And this is one area where some papers had a weakness. They didn't realize that everything up to the conclusion part, actually, or the correlation part, which is part 8, where it says collate and evaluate all evidence, actually everything up to that point is almost preliminary, you could say, in a way. Because it's just laying out what the information is and stating what some of the problems are. But it's all somewhat separate and artificially compartmentalized from each other, the areas are isolated. But when you get to the collate and evaluate, this would actually be perhaps the biggest section of your paper, or a pretty big section anyway, part A of number 8, because that's where you're drawing all together and you're saying, well, the lexical affects the grammatical this way, and this means that, and therefore we must translate it this way, and because of the alternate pointing, this meaning cannot have that, and that's where you're drawing it all together and you're stating why you're coming to certain conclusions, because you're evaluating it all. Now, it's hard not to evaluate it and come to conclusions as you're working your way through the paper, and that's, like I say, that's the one drawback that there is to it, but still it will take you to the right destination, which is your conclusion, if it's followed even rather rigorously. But the result sometimes is that you're going to have overlap in the various sections. You're going to find yourself repeating yourself in what you say under grammatical and lexical and theological or whatever, there will be a certain amount of overlap by the nature of the case. And so there is one drawback to it. What I feel that can be of a super help when you approach this kind of a study and you use this outline is, first of all, you have a reading of the verse that you're looking at, and you're reading it in various translations perhaps, and you're getting familiar with it. Then I feel that for most people, before you jump to reference works and start picking your way through this outline and looking at the parsing the words and looking at the grammar, looking at the form, before you do that, probably what would be good would be to produce an interlinear translation of that verse, whether it's the Greek or the Hebrew. Not only an interlinear, but have each word laid out. In fact, what I would probably do, this is a suggestion, I would have, let's say there's just five words in the verse. I would have, as a study guide before me, those five words listed out. And I would give the Hebrew, let's say if it's the Hebrew, then the transliteration, and then the translation of it. And I would do that for all five words, and I have that laid out in front of me as a study guide, so that when I'm going through the commentaries or the lexicons and the reference works, I've got an interlinear before me which tells me what they're talking about, because some reference works only use the Hebrew and don't give you a transliteration, let alone a translation of it. Other reference works, some of your more recent Hebrew reference works, are leaning towards transliterations of everything, and they don't give you the Hebrew characters, and they don't give you the translation. They just give you a transliteration, like the Theological Dictionary of the Old Testament does that a lot, that green three-volume work. We have three volumes, there's more coming out. And then others, some of your commentaries that are more popular or geared to the English reader, will give the translation of the verb, but they won't give you the Hebrew characters of the transliteration. So what I'm saying is, different reference works will zero in on one way or another of showing you the word when they're discussing the problem of the verse. And so if you don't have all the equivalents for each word in the verse laid out right before you always, sometimes you find yourself skimming over the remarks and you're not even paying attention to what word they're referring to, what word's being identified. But if you've got the whole thing, and you might even, and this might be a good way to get ready to parse it too, because then after that you could parse each word, so that when they say this verb comes from a root, and you say what verb, and then you're looking over your list and you already know there's only one verb in the verse, and that's the verb, and that's going to be it, so this is the word they're referring to. And if you've got this little study outline in front of you, I believe it can really help you to interpret the remarks that people are making when they're referring to verbs and roots and nouns and cognates and radicals, and they're using a transliteration, or they're just using the Hebrew or Greek characters, or they're just giving a translation. It'll correlate it so you know, because you've got to know what words they're talking about. If you don't, you're lost. The remarks mean exactly nothing if you don't know what words in the verse those remarks apply to. And this might be a good help and benefit to do really early in your study that will be a guide in your later use. Yes?
One thing I found useful is to have one page each word.
Even for each word.
Each Hebrew word.
Right. And then all the remarks that you gather from the things you can put on a separate page. Yeah, that would be another good way of doing it.
When you get to a concordance. Start piling up pretty fast and you can close.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that would be a good way to do it too. Let's see. That's about all the remarks I had, I guess, except I was going to say that I felt some papers hurt themselves by departing a little bit too much from the outline format. And it got hard for me to see where they followed it and where they did, what they left out and what they did. And so for the purposes of this assignment, it would have been best just to stick pretty rigidly to the outline. Most of them did. And that's really all the comments I'll have on this. If you have any others, this is the time to get them in. I'm going to go ahead and move on to another area. Keith. Roll book. That's a good comment. Thank you. Okay, we're going to hit a new area of Bible study today, and so you can turn over a new leaf, prepare to hit a new area. We may pick this outline up again later in the semester and hit it from a different angle or give you another assignment and to give you a kind of a second try to work with it now that you're a little more familiar with it. But for right now, we'll be leaving it and we'll be going to another area.
Just one quick question. If one wanted to do a study something like that but not get quite so meaty, what would be two or three areas there that you could pick, just say real quick, that you know, you might spend 2 hours instead of 6 or 7 hours to give you something to work with? I mean, could you probably get the like the syntax and the accent type of thing, maybe just go for more like the historical and the lexicological analysis?
Well,
in other words, can we abridge it to make a simpler version without destroying the book?
See, the thing about this outline is it actually looks more complex than it is because we put so much subheadings under each heading in so much detail. You know, when you try to say what area could you get away with dropping, I would be reluctant if I was doing a thorough study on a verse to drop any area because, first of all, let's look at the textual. You've got to hit the textual because you've got to know if that's what's in the Greek text or not before you just start to interpret it. Otherwise, you run the risk of spending hours and hours researching a verse that's not even in the Greek or that's read differently in the better manuscripts, but we've been going on a King James or an NAS translation or something and we made a mistake. So textual you've got to do. Lexical you've got to do because the meanings of words, that's what it's all about when you get down to it. Perhaps grammatical could be abbreviated a little bit more, that whole heading, because accidents and syntax, a lot of times that's something a mental step that you do real quick as you're looking at over the verse, and you don't always have to formalize it and write it out like we had you do here. But you do have to look at the grammatical. Historical, a lot of these things in the historical can a lot of times be omitted. That's one area where you can definitely take your knife and trim when you're doing it. Topography, climatology, flora and fauna, how often does that have a bearing on the interpretation of the verse? Seldom. Sometimes it does, particularly if you're in the historical books of the Old Testament and you're dealing with a war or a battle or an event, sometimes the topography will have something. Battle of Armageddon. You interpret some Battle of Armageddon verses in Ezekiel 38 and 39, you've got to know the topography of the land and who's coming where and what mountains they're going over and where they're gathering and where they're heading and so forth. But usually not, especially when you're in the New Testament and you're in the epistles of Paul. How often in his logical developments of theology do you have to know, you know, topography or climatology to determine you don't? So that's one area that you can often take the knife and trim. Theological analysis is always going to be involved. Exegetical, of course, is just kind of collating everything and bringing it together. So I would say that all of these areas would be needed, but to a greater or lesser degree, depending on what area of the Bible you were in, what type of literature you were looking at, and how much in-depth you were going to do. Any other questions? All right. I want to talk today about another type of Bible study or another approach to studying the Bible. And in this approach, we're faced with the difficulty of what we're going to term it, for one thing. What term we're going to use to describe it. It's rather difficult to describe it. For lack of a better term, I've called it overview study. So if you want to use that for a term, that's all right, overview study. But know that other teachers or other writers or books might use different terms to describe what is basically the same type of study. One author calls it the synthetic method of Bible study. That doesn't mean it's plastic, but synthetic, he's using that word in the original sense of the word. You know, soon together with, it means the putting together. So in the synthetic method, you're putting things together, which is the opposite of what we just looked at in this analytical method where you're taking things apart. Because that's exactly what this verse outline that we gave you did. It takes a verse and it breaks it apart. Just like taking a car motor apart and analyzing all its various parts. That's all you're doing. You're analyzing the pistons and the carburetor and the crankshaft and the bearings, and you're seeing how they function together with each other, and then you put it back together. Well, in this overview study, you're just looking, you're putting things together and you're not taking things apart. It's a little bit different approach. Fred Hornbecker likes to call it the conceptual method. So you might want to be aware of that phraseology, the conceptual method, meaning you're dealing with a larger, with a concept rather than with a detail or a verse. Topical method? Well, no, it's not really the topical method. I think it, you'll see as I go on to define it, because it's really what you could call it is the book method. The book method. Because as I am going to apply it, I'm going to apply it to a Bible book. One Bible book when taken as a whole. And so that would differ from the topical where you would follow faith, for example, throughout every Bible book and put it together. But this is just dealing with the book as a whole. I think it's extremely important to always remember that in the autograph there were no chapter divisions, there were no verse divisions. That can really be an important factor sometimes. And I believe that these letters and books that form the Bible, these 66 books, were meant to be read as a whole. Now, admittedly, they do contain divisions, okay? And though Mr. A may differ from Scholar B as to where exactly those divisions would be, you know, when they're going to outline the book or if they're going to make their translation or their versification of it, still, we do have to admit that there are divisions of thought. And these divisions are marked by certain transitions, okay? If I was going to write a research paper, or let's say I was going to do a doctoral dissertation on, end time events. That would be a big area, but overview of end time events. Obviously, I would have different segments of thought. You know, the rapture, the tribulation, the plague, Armageddon, second coming, millennium, short season, new heavens and new earth. And so even though my book is on one main theme, the end of time or the end time events, there are obvious segments of thought that make up the book, and these segments are, there are transitions which help you to move from one segment to another. So I'm not denying that there are segments in these Bible books. But what I'm saying is that each book should still be treated as a unit, because that's what it was written as. It was written as a unit to convey one main theme. Therefore, it was meant to be read as a whole. Now, we know that because God is the ultimate author of all 66 books, that we have every right and even the need to be able to compare, you know, verses and words and terms and concepts from all the various books and put them together to formulate a systematic theology or a systematic teaching or doctrine. And we have every right to do that, even though they were 35 different men writing from different climates and cultures and over 1,500 years, yet there's a unity of theme and purpose in all the 66 books. But still, I go back to my original thesis that they still are separate books that should be read as a whole, as a unit. And so in this overview method, or overview approach to Bible study, what a person wants to do is read through that book several times. That's going to be the main thing that you're going to do to understand that book as unit is to read it several times through. Each reading does not necessarily have to be in rapid succession. By that I mean you don't necessarily have to sit down for a two-hour block, for example, and read the book through 10 times. In fact, that can sometimes be counterproductive, because if you read it too many times through at one sitting, you'll begin to lose your sense of perspective on what's being said. You'll begin to lose your feel for the theme of the book, and after a while it'll just become, you know, more words, and it'll become so repetitive that after a while your mind will tire of it and you won't understand what you're reading. So sometimes it's better only to read it maybe once or twice at a sitting and then leave it for a little while and come back and read it again. In fact, what we want to do in this method is each time we read the book, we want to read it from a little bit different angle. By that I mean we want to read it looking for a little bit different aspect of the total organization of the book, or of the teaching of the book as a whole. And what we want to do is, each time we read the book, at the end of that sitting, when we've read through it once, we should immediately, while they're still fresh in our mind, write down the thoughts that we have after we've read it, concerning the angle that we've read it from. I'll develop this a little bit more in a minute. Then at the end, after having read the book, let's say, for example, five times, we should have five, you know, groups of paper, or five pieces of paper. After each reading, we've written our thoughts down. Then we should be able to compare all those pieces of paper, to collect them and integrate them into one teaching on the purpose and intent of the book, one thesis. Now, the first time you read the book, you should be looking for the main theme of the book. This first reading should be careful, but it should also be rapid. Okay? You don't want to get bogged down in detail the first time you read the book. You just want to read it at a rather rapid pace, but carefully assimilating it as you go. And you should be asking yourself, in your mind, as you're reading the book, what is the uppermost idea in the author's mind? What is Paul getting at? What is his main idea in writing this book? And how is he seeking to develop that idea? How is he developing it? How does he seek to develop that idea? Another question you want to have in your mind is, does any one verse or passage state this idea more definitely than any other? I'll repeat that for you. Does any one verse or passage in this book state that main idea more clearly than any other? So in other words, you're looking for kind of a key passage or key verse that will kind of succinctly sum up what this main idea of the author is, okay? And that's all you want to do for first reading through. And those are the questions you will seek to answer as you write down your thoughts after one rapid reading of the book. Now you come back to it. You come back to it fresh, and you sit down and you read the whole book again at one sitting. But this time, you're looking at it for something else. You're looking at it for development. Development. By that I mean this. You are assuming that the theme that you have arrived at is the proper theme for the author, okay, after your first reading. Let's say the theme is justification by faith. Okay, we'll pretend that's the theme of your book. Now, the second time you read it, you say, all right, how does Paul develop that theme of justification by faith? How is he developing it? Well, he's developing it by showing that we are justified by the blood of Jesus Christ. And the blood of Jesus Christ is efficacious for all sin. And when we are in Christ, there's no condemnation, and therefore we are justified by our faith in his atoning work. So maybe you found four different angles that Paul uses, four different arguments, four different aspects that he uses to develop the theme, justification by faith. How he develops it. Just like Don develops a sermon. He's usually got one or more, usually about one, main ideas that he wants to get across to the congregation. Maybe the idea of we need to be fortified in our minds against the devil. Well, it'd be interesting to sit and listen and ask yourself, how is he developing that? Well, he starts with a thesis based upon a New Testament verse. You know, resist the devil and he'll flee from you. And then maybe to develop that, he'll go into the Old Testament and show you in the lives of certain Old Testament characters how they had to stand against the physical enemy and how they used certain weapons and tactics which he can draw spiritual applications from. And then he can come back and hit some other New Testament verses to buttress those truths. How does he develop that theme? That's what you're looking for in the second reading. And then you write down those thoughts when you're done. Right, then you come back on your third and fourth reading, which I'm putting together. Your third and fourth readings of the book, you are seeking to find an outline of the book. Not by looking in a New Testament or Old Testament introduction and copying somebody's outline, but rather through your own reading of it. What do you think the outline of the book is? Now, when you're done with your third and fourth reading, or I should say after the fourth reading, you should have produced, be able to produce on a piece of paper a textual outline of the book. A textual outline of the book. Now, let me hit these in a little bit more detail, the third and fourth. The third reading is what I'm going to call your exploratory reading. And in your exploratory reading, you're looking for, excuse me, a logical development of the theme. Now, this is either harder or easier to find depending on what Bible book you're reading. For example, it may be very difficult to find a logical development of the theme of the book of Proverbs. I'm just guessing, but it might be. But on the other hand, the book of Ecclesiastes, written by the same pen, you could probably find a real logical development of his theme that without God, that is, under the sun, all is vanity of vanities and vexation of spirits. And he does use a rather logical development, looking at nature, looking at man, looking at man's career, man's philosophy, and so forth. There's a logical development of his thesis that without God, everything is vain and without purpose. Okay. And in Paul's writings, of course, you find the epitome of a logical development of a theme. And so the third exploratory reading will be relatively easy in most of the Pauline epistles. It may be a little more difficult in some of your Old Testament books. But we have to go on the basis that even though God is the ultimate author of these books, he did use human authors who have a mind who was developing this theme. Even though in some mystical way God was guiding their thoughts and their words in such a way that they were perfect, doctrinally, without error, inerrant, and prophetic, and so forth and so on, yet it's amazing that you can still see the human imprint in them. For example, there is difference in style from one writer to another. There is difference in vocabulary. Luke uses some highfalutin Greek language, so to speak, that maybe Peter or some others don't use. And so there, you can see the human imprint there, you know, even though through it all and behind it all is the divine. And so because there is a human imprint there, you would expect that when John or Peter or Paul or James or Moses or Solomon sat down to write a book, that when they had a theme that they wanted to bring, there was some logical way of presenting or developing that theme. Just like when you sit down to write an essay or a research paper, you've got an idea in mind and then you have some kind of a methodical way of approaching that idea. The more you read Bible books, the more you will begin to pick up little clues that will help you to find out how that author is developing his theme. One clue, for example, is that the author comes right out and announces that he's hitting another area, and therefore you're into another development, a second stage in his development of his theme or idea. Let me give you a couple examples. Look at 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 1. 1 Corinthians 7, verse 1. But here we're on message 2, nobody has Bibles with them. We're beyond that stage, right? We've got to memorize now. Paul says, if you don't have one, you might want to look on with somebody else or just share it here. Paul says, "Now concerning the things whereof ye wrote unto me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman." Now he has come right out and announced that he's hitting a new stage in the development of his theme to the Corinthian church. "Now concerning the things whereof you wrote to me." Notice also verse 25. "Now concerning virgins, I have no commandment of the Lord." So here's another stage in the development of Paul's idea. Look at chapter 8, verse 1. "Now as touching things offered unto idols," we know that we all have knowledge. "So now this, now that, now this." He's announcing to you that he's hit another stage in his development of his idea. So some of those can become very easy to follow when you're on your third exploratory reading and trying to find out how is he developing his theme. Well, Paul's developing it by announcing it. Now I'm talking about virgins. Now I'm talking about meat offered to idols. Now I'm talking about marriage. See? The book of Hebrews has certain signposts like that. "Let us therefore fear. Let us therefore leave the elementary principles of Christ and press on to perfection. Let us take heed. Let us fear. Let us enter into that rest." See, let us. Those are more signposts that if you're keen at and you're reading you can pick up on. Other transitions will let you know if he changes subject, even if he doesn't announce that change, although there's almost always an announcement for a change of subject, isn't there? Even if it's a relatively subtle announcement, like a conjunction or you know, gar in the Greek, or some, or you know, some preliminary word to start off a new subject. Changes in subject will be an indicator then. Change in person, change in rhetorical form. These can be some of the various clues to help you to find out how the author is developing his theme. Because what you'll be looking for is breakpoints. Where has he stopped on that stage of the development of this idea and started another? All right? The breakpoints are going to be key to find. Now, see, there's a breakpoint right there. What you want to do in this third reading is, this could be helpful anyway, try to follow the text by paragraph. By paragraph. Because a paragraph, by the very definition of it, is a unit of thought, which is separate from the preceding unit or paragraph and from the following unit. Now, this is where it can be helpful to use a Bible translation that has already been put in paragraph form. Although you are at their mercy as to where those paragraph breakpoints are, at least it can give you an idea of where they feel the paragraph breakpoints are. And you may either agree or disagree with them at any one point. And what you're doing is, you read each paragraph, noting its content as a unit. Here's one unit, idols, one paragraph. Here's a unit, marriage, another paragraph. Here's a unit, see, this, another paragraph. Now that, you do all that in your third reading. Now your fourth reading. In your fourth reading, you should be able to crystallize the teaching of the various paragraphs into an integrated outline. Now what do I mean by that? Well, let me see if I can conceptualize it on the board for you. Let's say that this book has 10 paragraphs. Let's just say it has 8, because I ran out of space. Those 10 paragraphs in this book, or chapter, or whatever you're reading, each one is kind of a unit of thought. But when you go to outline it, maybe the first three paragraphs still are tied together by a certain unity of subject. So they might be Roman numeral 1 on your outline. The next two paragraphs are tied together by a unity of subject. They might be part 2 on your outline. And then the last three paragraphs might be also tied together, and they're part 3 on your outline. And all of these are a logical development and progression of the theme that you have discovered for that book. Okay? And that's what you're doing. In your fourth reading, you're crystallizing the teaching of the various paragraphs into an integrated outline. And when you're done with it, you should have two things. You should have your paragraph paper showing the paragraph divisions, and then you should have your final outline of that book. Now, they say an example is worth 1,000 words. I'm going to pass out an example of both of these things to you that are taken from Merrill F. Tenney's book, Galatians, The Charter of Christian Liberty. And I've done it on the back side of the page here, both sides of the page. On one side, he has made a chart of the paragraphs in the book of Galatians. So here you see how he broke it down into paragraphs. Then on the back, you'll see his final outline, and how he stuck those paragraphs into a regular formal outline of the book. And this, your assignment is to do what he did with Galatians, but you read the book of Colossians and do that. So your assignment will be to apply this method to the book of Colossians, just as we've showed you, and to hand in a paragraph outline like what he's got here, or a paragraph chart, just like he's got it, except you don't have to do one by the Greek Testament if you don't want. You can just do one by an English translation. Okay, he's got a broken down ASV version and Message Greek text. But you can just do one chart based upon NAS or NIV or whatever translation you're looking at. Okay, you don't have to go into the Greek text. So I want that, and then I also want the outline like he's got here for the book of Colossians, and that'll be due next week. Okay, question?
Not quite sure what you want. Week after next. That's right. You've got break to work on it, too. You're not sure what I want. Well, what's your question?
I'm not sure how to answer yet.
What's the paragraph outline?
The paragraph outline is going to look like the one that I just handed out to you on that chart, except it doesn't have to have the part from the Greek text, okay? That's the one you're looking at right there. He's done that for the book of Galatians. You do one just like that that outlines the book of Colossians, okay? And so all you're doing is from your third and fourth readings, you have put it in paragraphs. See, the King James Version didn't put it in paragraphs. They've just got verse by verse, although they've indicated by those paragraph marks where they feel maybe some of the paragraph beginnings might be. Well, what I want you to do is to tell me through your readings about where you feel the paragraph divisions would be in that book if you were outlining it, and put it in a chart form similar to what he's got there, okay? But paragraph outline does not equal outline. And that's where the other side of that piece of paper comes in. I want you to give me your final outline as well, okay? That's about the best way I can explain it. A paragraph is a unit of thought, like I said, and from your reading of the book, you should be able to find out where those paragraphs are. Maybe one paragraph consists of 5 verses, and then the next 10 verses belong together, they're the next paragraph. Then the next 2 verses go together, they're a paragraph, just like he's done there. Okay?
I follow that part about discerning where the paragraphs